It is Friday, November 6, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, voters in Myanmar prepare to cast ballots in Sunday's parliamentary elections. We talk with an analyst about it.
The Myanmar of 2015 is an increasingly cosmopolitan, globally connected society.
Egypt suspends British flights into Sinai as the investigation into the crash of a Russian airliner last weekend continues, and country music star Trisha Yearwood is honored with an award in Nashville. It's all ahead. Myanmar has been ruled for five decades by a military junta that handpicked a nominally civilian government in 2011. On Sunday, the Southeast Asian nation, formerly known as Burma, will vote in what's being touted by the government as a free and fair election. Myanmar President Thein Sein has again pledged to hold free and fair elections, with the result reflecting what he called the people's genuine desire. Nicholas Farrelly, director of the Myanmar Research Center at the Australian National University, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this is a momentous occasion in the political life of a country that has known little democracy. He says the true significance of the outcome won't be known until after the polls have closed, but in the weeks and months during a period of negotiation and compromise.
There's almost no comparison in the sense that the Myanmar of 1990 had just lurched out of a quarter century of socialist isolation. The Myanmar of 2015 is an increasingly cosmopolitan, globally connected society, which has, during this recent period of relative economic success, seen many millions of people vault out of poverty for the first time. The penetration of the internet and mobile phone technology is, of course, at an all-time high. The media is relatively free to report as it sees fit on sensitive political, social, and economic issues. But the country isn't anymore in a category all of its own. It has become one of Southeast Asia's semi-democracies. And as a result, I think we need to be somewhat careful about the comparisons that we draw with the events of 1990. Those events, of course, occurred in the immediate wake of the violence of 1988. There hasn't been that level of political consternation on the streets of Yangon or Myanmar's other big cities in recent times. And we all hope, of course, that through this electoral process, there'll be further opportunities for the Myanmar people to get to grips with just how much their country has changed.
Well, the country has no opinion polls, of course, but can anyone match the size and enthusiasm of the supporters of the National League for Democracy?
I very much doubt that anybody can match Aung San Suu Kyi's support base. Whether that translates into seats in the legislatures is a very different kind of question. Myanmar has a first-past-the-post voting system. That means that where there's relatively even competition, it's very hard to predict who it is might come up with the result. In many constituencies, there is at least a handful of different parties that are contesting, all of which are trying to put forward the most competitive possible candidates. Aung San Suu Kyi is trying to tell people that they should vote for her and vote for her party. We'll have to wait and see whether that's the kind of advice that the voters will follow.
Human Rights Watch has already issued a press release saying the election is fundamentally flawed. The process is undermined, it says, by systematic and structural problems, including the lack of an independent election commission, ruling party dominance of state media, a reservation of a quarter of the seats for the military, discriminatory voter registration laws, mass disenfranchisement of voters in some parts of the country.
Not a pretty picture, and I think Human Rights Watch is right to be pointing out the many flaws in the process that's underway right now. I'd suggest, though, that we need to maintain a certain level of optimism about what's going on. We are seeing a new level of electoral competition. There is simply no track record in Myanmar of doing anything like this. And the fact that the old military regime appears to be gradually surrendering a great deal of its power and authority suggests to me at least that good things might follow. Of course, it would be wonderful if Myanmar had the capacity to run an election of the sort that would pass muster with most advanced democracies around the world. That's unrealistic. A huge amount of effort has been put into trying to get some of these institutions up to a reasonable standard. I'd suggest, though, that we'll be waiting for at least another few iterations of this electoral practice before Myanmar has consolidated a system which is going to convince the sceptics and the critics that it is democratic to the level that some would like to see.
That's Nicholas Fairley. He's director of the Myanmar Research Center at the Australian National University. In other news, Egypt has suspended British flights from flying into the Sinai Peninsula. Plans to evacuate hundreds of stranded Britons from a resort town in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula were put on hold on Friday. Meanwhile, Britain has grounded all flights returning to the country from the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The move follows U.S. and British intelligence reports suggesting the Russian Metrojet plane that crashed Saturday after takeoff from Sharm el-Sheikh was downed by a bomb. Henry Ridgewell reports from the British capital.
Britain is the first country to halt all flights out of Sharm el-Sheikh following Saturday's Metrojet crash. At a news conference with visiting Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Prime Minister David Cameron said he was acting to protect the 20,000 British tourists scheduled to fly home from the Egyptian airport during the coming days.
Of course, I cannot be sure, my experts cannot be sure, that it was a terrorist bomb that brought down that Russian plane. But if the intelligence is, and the judgment is, that that is a more likely than not outcome, then I think it's right to act in the way that I did.
Britain has sent security teams to Sharm el-Sheikh to check security measures. El-Sisi said they are welcome. The Egyptian leader says we are completely ready to cooperate with all our friends to make sure that the security measures taken at our airport provide the safety and security needed for the people who come to us. Britain is acting on its own intelligence sources, says security expert Sajan Gohel of the Asia Pacific Foundation.
The anniversary is coming up of the ISIS affiliate in Egypt declaring its loyalty to the leader of the organization, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and there was electronic chatter that was suggesting that there could potentially be another attack on the aviation industry.
Russia and Egypt have said it is too early to speculate on the cause of the crash. They should release more details from the investigation, says Gohel.
Keep in mind that Egypt and Russia stand to lose a lot if it's proved that this is terrorism.
Outside Cameron's Downing Street residence, dozens of human rights campaigners demonstrated against the Egyptian president's visit. But security, rather than concerns over democracy, will dominate El-Sisi's two-day visit. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. Well, the news that more and more people are suspecting the plane was taken down by a bomb has spread pretty fast. Between David Cameron and now U.S. President Obama suggesting a bomb could have caused the crash, even though the investigation hasn't technically proved that terrorism was responsible yet, it's starting to become the consensus between users on social media. When we first heard that ISIS was claiming responsibility for the attack, I actually saw a number of people on social media platforms urging others to wait for confirmation, given that terrorist organizations often will say anything to get attention. But the effect that having Western countries suggest a bomb could have been responsible and also diverting flights away from Egypt, it's leading a lot of people on social media to just accept that as the conclusion.
Well, Olin, what else is happening on social media?
So big news yesterday, the Obama administration released the full text of the TPP, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and there's been a lot of talk about the deal online. Many U.S. politicians quickly turned to social media to voice disapproval with the agreement, but across the internet, it's actually getting a pretty negative response overall.
Well, it's a pretty big document. What aspects of the agreement are getting the most attention?
That's right. It's 30 chapters long, hundreds of pages. It's probably safe to say very few people are going to actually read the entire agreement. Yesterday, when the full text was released, it was posted on the social media site Reddit, and it very quickly became the top post on the front page. It was really interesting to watch the crowdsourcing of people on this online community dissect the trade agreement. And what ended up happening was the pieces about copyright in the deal, they picked up the most traction. But not everyone believes that this kind of social media crowdsourcing can be productive. One user wrote, "Thousands of clueless people giving a summation of a single report. What could go wrong?" That comment received 2,000 upvotes, which is how Reddit measures a post's success. So it'll really be interesting to compare what Reddit users come up with reading the document with how experts end up interpreting it.
All right. Thanks very much, Olin. That's Olin Akisholu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
As NASA continues its preparations to resume human spaceflight launches and readies its ambitious Journey to Mars program, it is putting out a help wanted sign. The space agency will soon accept applications for its next class of astronauts who will fly from the space coast of Florida aboard new American-made commercial spacecraft. Among the qualifications required to become a NASA astronaut candidate are U.S. citizenship and a bachelor's degree in either engineering, mathematics, or biological or physical sciences. Advanced degrees are, of course, preferred. Applications will be accepted from December the 14th until the middle of February 2016. NASA will take about 18 months to go through all the applications, and they'll announce the new astronaut candidates in mid-2017. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Trisha Yearwood is honored by the music industry in Nashville. U.S. authorities are investigating whether a Los Angeles-based media company is majority owned by a subsidiary of the state-run China Radio International. The Beijing-based Guangguang Century Media Consultancy. According to Reuters, the company, G&E Studio Incorporated, owned by U.S. naturalized citizen James Su, leases two U.S. radio stations, one in Washington and one in Philadelphia, and provides more than 100 hours of English and Chinese programming to more than a dozen other stations. U.S. law prohibits foreign entities from holding broadcast licenses, but allows up to 20% direct foreign ownership of a station or 25% of a U.S. parent corporation of a station. The Federal Communications Commission, along with the U.S. Justice Department, says it has launched an inquiry to determine the facts surrounding foreign ownership issues raised in the media report. U.S. law also requires anyone in the U.S. trying to influence American policy or opinion on behalf of a foreign government or group to register with the Justice Department. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, China has for a long time practiced what it calls public opinion warfare.
And it would not be surprising if, after the investigations are concluded, it was to be found that some actors in the United States, as actors have elsewhere in other parts of the world, including Australia, Europe, and across East Asia, have been influenced by Chinese efforts to shape public opinion in ways that are favorable to or that tell the positive story of China's development over the past several decades and that seek to downplay negatives. Of course, this is something that we see actively in the print media when you see inserts from China Daily showing up in the Washington Post or the New York Times. This is part of China's effort to try to shape its image overseas, to head off possible challenges to the regime's legitimacy, and to try to ensure that countries from all corners of the world do not pose any sort of threat to the Chinese Communist Party's ruling status.
So you see some substance to the story. You think it's a serious matter.
Well, certainly the Reuters story, which I think is what you're referring to, goes into very extensive depth and is based on extensive fieldwork. So, yes, that particular piece of research, which I think has served as the basis for this whole issue making waves in the press, yes, I think that seemed to me on first read through to be a credible piece of reporting, and it seems like a very plausible story.
Associated Press is carrying it, too, and refers to this owner of this organization called G&E Studio, James Su, a naturalized U.S. citizen originating from Shanghai. Do you know anything about him?
Not someone who I'd ever heard of before, but of course, if you look at what China has done, even with its own media outreach, by trying to create CCTV International, by creating these web-based productions that describe Papa Xi Jinping or Daddy Xi Jinping, Xi Dada, or their most recent creation, which describes the 13th five-year plan. These are all done in English to try to shape overseas audiences' impressions of China. So I would think that it would not at all be surprising that this would be a continuation of that effort by different means.
This is probably a violation of FCC rules and regulations about foreign ownership of broadcast facilities.
China's own modus operandi in areas where it deems its national security interests to be at stake, or in this case, its regime interests to be at stake, has not historically respected domestic laws of foreign countries. And in fact, I recall you and I had a conversation several months back when there were some suspicions that Chinese state agents might be in place in the United States trying to pressure corrupt Chinese officials who may have fled to the United States. So this is a continuing concern. Of course, in any case, you know, we operate by the rule of law and we'll follow appropriate procedures to ensure that people are innocent until proven guilty. But it seems to me to be a case where there may be merit to investigating further and trying to do so through a legal proceeding.
That's Scott Harold of the RAND Corporation. The publication Business Insider says a Reuters investigation found that 33 radio stations on four continents in 14 countries are part of a global radio network that primarily broadcasts content such as news, music, and cultural programming created or supplied by China Radio International or media companies it controls. It says newscasts include stories about China's developments, such as its space program, and its contributions to humanitarian causes, including earthquake relief in Nepal. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sagan, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Of artists like Taylor Swift talking about licensing fees and royalties, chances are you've heard of ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. They help ensure that its members are compensated for the use of their music, whether it's via broadcast or live performance. ASCAP also celebrates its top members in a series of annual award shows in various music categories, including country. This past Monday, the ASCAP Country Awards took place, and Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to tell us all about it. Well, Nikki, even though it was the ASCAP Country Awards, pop artist Justin Timberlake and former President Jimmy Carter were a part of it.
Yes, Sarah. Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Carter were there to honor country music icon, singer, actress, and author Trisha Yearwood with the prestigious Voice of Music Award. Many of us know her from her big crossover hit How Do I Live from the movie Con Air. So Justin Timberlake is a Tennessee native, so he was raised around country music, and he's been a Trisha Yearwood fan. So he honored her with an extensive speech emphasizing her music accomplishments. So multiple award winner, including 3 Grammys. She recently released her 12th studio album. She has an extensive list of hits. As an artist, Justin said, and this is true, that Trisha has given young women a voice through song with powerful lyrics of love, loss, and staying true to yourself. And former President Jimmy Carter, a fellow Georgia native like Trisha and Habitat for Humanity supporter, actually presented her with the award. And he personally knew her and her husband, Garth Brooks, especially as volunteers for Habitat for Humanity. And he said that Trisha is actually one of the best Habitat for Humanity volunteers he has ever seen. He said she's always on top of the scaffolding and she's doing a lot of the dangerous things, he said, that make a lot of men like him ashamed. But overall, bravo to Trisha Yearwood. This is an award well deserved. There was a great music tribute to her as well with Lady Antebellum, Reba McEntire, and Trisha's daughter, Allie Brooks, performing.
Wow, that just sounds great. Well, who else was honored at the event?
Well, Sam Hunt was honored with Songwriter Artist of the Year Award, and his song Leave the Night On was named ASCAP Song of the Year. And Ashley Gourley received the Songwriter of the Year honor.
Well, the coveted Country Music Association Awards happened this week as well.
Yes, it's like award week heaven.
Okay, well, we'll have to stay posted. You can catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach her on social media at @VOA_music on Twitter or simply VOA Music on Facebook. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
And tell me now, how do I live without you? I want to know, how do I breathe without you? If you ever go, how do I ever survive? How do I?
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council is supporting an African Union, or AU, decision to investigate human rights abuses in Burundi. The 15-member council said in a unanimous statement issued on October 28 that it was deeply concerned by the continued rise in violence in Burundi following the re-election of leader Pierre Nkurunziza. The United States welcomes the United Nations Security Council's presidential statement on Burundi and the council's continued attention to this crisis. Like the AU's communique of October 17, the Security Council statement put particular stress on the urgency of convening an inclusive inter-Burundian dialogue among the government and peaceful stakeholders within and outside the country. As such, the Security Council reemphasized the importance of the mediation efforts led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on behalf of the East African community and as endorsed by the AU. The United States stresses the Security Council's call for any dialogue to be inclusive and represent the voices of the citizens of Burundi, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. He said the U.S. also welcomes the Security Council's strong condemnation of all violations and abuses of human rights and acts of unlawful violence committed in Burundi, both by security forces as well as by militias and other illegal armed groups, and its expressed determination to seek accountability for the perpetrators of such acts. Mr. Kirby noted that the U.S. is encouraged by the leadership of the United Nations in addressing the ongoing crisis in Burundi, particularly through Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's public offer in his October 27th statement of any support necessary to advance the implementation of the measures agreed upon by the members of the AU Peace and Security Council. The United States stands ready to support the AU, the EAC, and its designated mediator, President Museveni, and the citizens of Burundi to urgently conduct such regionally mediated dialogue outside of Burundi, which represents the best path forward to resolving the insecurity which has plagued the country since President Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term in contravention of the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Agreement.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.